truth is that the nature of UN peacekeeping has changed fundamentally. So now, in the past 20 years or so, there's been a real focus on the protection of civilians and everything that's entailed. So that includes protecting civilians from rebel groups operating at the country level, but it also includes really knowing how to stop and prevent communal violence before it occurs.
Welcome back to Scope Conditions. I'm Yung-Yung Zhou from Dartmouth College.
And I'm Alan Jacobs from the University of British Columbia. Today on Scope Conditions, what's the secret to successful peacekeeping?
We often think of civil conflict as being driven by organized armed groups, like rebel militias and state armies. But as our guest today reminds us, a leading cause of conflict around the world is communal violence. Fights that break out between civilians over land, cattle, water, and other scarce resources. When the United Nations sends peacekeepers in to manage a conflict, one of their most important jobs is diffusing tensions among neighbors, preventing local disputes from spiraling into widespread violence and derailing a larger peace process.
Dr. William D'Amicos is an assistant professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara. In his forthcoming book, Local Peace, International Builders, How the UN Builds Peace from the Bottom Up, Will asks why peacekeepers sometimes manage, but other times fail, to keep a lid on communal violence. As he explains to us, the key to successful peacekeeping is being perceived by local populations as an impartial mediator among contending groups.
But the thing is, a reputation for impartiality isn't something that a peacekeeping force can manufacture overnight. Whether or not peacekeepers are seen as unbiased in a communal dispute is often shaped by experiences that long predate the contemporary conflict, such as the legacies of colonialism. It turns out that deployments by former colonizers, like French peacekeepers sent to Mali, have a pretty hard time tamping down local conflicts.
Will walks us through the micro-level logic of his theory of impartial peacekeeping, grounded in the psychology of group conflict. We then discuss his multi-pronged empirical strategy for testing the theory, using a novel, highly granular data set on peacekeeping deployments, in-depth interviews with communal leaders, and lab-in-the-field experiments in Mali.
And we talk about the policy implications of his findings. Is the UN uniquely capable of generating perceptions of fairness and managing communal violence, or can NGOs or regional bodies also get the job done?
How do revelations of abusive and exploitative behavior by some UN peacekeepers complicate the impartiality picture?
And if the presence of neutral arbiters is crucial for keeping a lid on violence, then what's the peacekeeper's exit strategy?
We hope you enjoy this conversation. To stay informed about future episodes, follow us on social media, subscribe on your podcast app, and check out our website, scopeconditionspodcast.com, where you can also find references to all the academic works we discuss. And if you like the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
Now, here's our conversation with William D'Amicos.
Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here.
So your book is about the conditions under which UN peacekeeping can reduce violence. Now, we often think about UN peacekeeping as a way to keep armed groups from shooting at each other again. So we think of it often as being about enforcing peace at the level of an overall conflict. But your book turns the focus to the local level and to what's often called communal violence. To start us out, what exactly is communal violence?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and you're absolutely right. The thing that really motivated this project is not this country-level violence that we typically associate with the UN, but this much more localized form of violence. And the primary difference here between communal violence and other forms of political violence is that there's usually no violent actor competing for control of the state that's involved in communal violence. So when I first started researching this project, I traveled to Mali, and I really thought I was going to be studying this big ethnic conflict between a government and separatist forces. And I quickly realized that there was a bigger concern, and that's what you're talking about here, communal violence. This is violence that's not between rebel groups and governments. There's no actor that's competing for control of the state. So typically, this is individuals, families, clans. This is groups that have to live with each other, sometimes well after the actual bout of communal violence is over. This is something that you can witness firsthand in Mali. It happens all the time. So to give you an example of just how violent communal violence can be. In January of 2019, members of the Dogon ethnic group, who tend to be farmers, violently attacked and slaughtered 39 civilians from the Fulani ethnic group that tend to be cattle herders. And this was over a dispute just about cattle treading on the land of the Dogon farmers. So there you get something where it's not an instance necessarily of a rebel group attacking civilians. It's more retribution for something that is a very local level issue. Cattle going over someone else's territory. And this was just one instance, and dozens of civilians died as a result. But more generally, this is something that is happening on a much larger scale around the world. There have been almost 500,000 people that have died as a result of communal violence. And this is according to the ACLED data project, just in the 21st century alone. So 500,000, I mean, that's a really large number. And even more concerning, I think, is that this is an increasing trend. So more and more people are dying from communal violence every single year. And given the role that I think climate change plays in displacing populations and creating these types of disputes at the local level, I think this is something that is only going to increase over the course of the 21st century.
As we've mentioned, your book is specifically about the effect of UN peacekeeping on communal violence. And at first glance, that might seem like a kind of surprising juxtaposition. We often think about the UN as trying to keep the peace between warring factions or militia groups at the country level. And we might think that it's going to be the local police or some other very local actor who'd be dealing with communal disputes. Why would it make sense for the UN to get involved in these very local level tensions and conflicts?
Yeah, that's a great question. The truth is that the nature of UN peacekeeping has changed fundamentally. So it's changed from the Cold War, when you'd get a lot of small UN peacekeeping operations, keeping the peace between countries like India and Pakistan, to the post-Cold War era, where you have UN peacekeepers not doing much of anything while hundreds of thousands of people get slaughtered in Rwanda. And now it's changed fundamentally on a much deeper level. And part of that change comes from past failures, like in Rwanda, or another infamous example is the UN standing by in Bosnia during the Srebrenica massacre. These failures really shook the UN in the late 20th century up until the early 21st century and really changed the way that the UN does its peacekeeping. So now, in the past 20 years or so, there's been a real focus on the protection of civilians and everything that's entailed. So that includes protecting civilians from rebel groups operating at the country level, but it also includes really knowing how to stop and prevent communal violence before it occurs. And this is something that really came through when I was talking to UN peacekeepers in Mali. So I was talking to a UN police officer, and this was at the very beginning of this project when I was still under the impression that UN peacekeepers didn't really do much intervening at the local level. And even though he was more senior, he just knew so much about people's communal disputes, and he really knew traditional leaders and the people that manage and mitigate these disputes throughout the area that he was in charge of patrolling, or his officers were in charge of patrolling, it really struck me and it changed the nature that I thought of UN peacekeeping. And that's kind of the more general experience now of peacekeepers and UN police officers throughout UN peacekeeping. And that's really how we should be thinking about UN peacekeeping in the 21st century and moving forward.
Next, can you just lay out some basics for us of how UN peacekeeping works? Like, where did they decide to send their forces and how many?
Yeah, so I think the most surprising thing about UN peacekeeping is how much of it is actually occurring. So from any given time in the past 20 years, there's been anywhere between 80 and 100,000 peacekeeping personnel deployed around the world. And the budget for these missions is pretty big. Some of the more expensive ones, of which there's four or five, is upwards of $1 billion a year. So these are big operations. And I think before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there were more UN peacekeepers deployed in foreign countries than any other military force deployed anywhere around the world. So the key thing to understand about UN peacekeeping operations is that they require the authorization, or sometimes known as a mandate, of the UN Security Council. So this is the main governing body of the UN. It consists of 15 countries. Five of these are permanent members, and this reflects the status quo at the end of World War II when the UN was established. So this is the United States, the UK, France, China, and Russia. Now, the key point, given that UN peacekeeping operations require the approval of the UN Security Council, is that any one of those five permanent members can veto any authorization or any mandate for a UN peacekeeping operation. So as a result, a lot of peacekeeping operations are basically dead on arrival. There's no way that they can become authorized because they can't go through the Security Council. That means, just by nature of great power politics, peacekeeping in the 21st century is a mostly African phenomenon, because that is the only place where the five permanent members can really agree on a peacekeeping operation. So whenever there's a conflict, whether it's in Syria or in Afghanistan or in Ukraine, I always get asked this question of, couldn't you have a UN peacekeeping operation there? And the problem, as always, is going to be the veto of one of the five permanent members. So as a result, it turns out that most peacekeeping operations that have become authorized in the past 20 years are in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's because none of the five permanent members of the Security Council has any core strategic interests that they feel would be threatened by a UN peacekeeping operation in sub-Saharan Africa.
Now let's jump into your argument. What is your core claim about what allows UN peacekeeping to be effective in preventing or containing communal violence?
My basic argument is that peacekeeping at the local level succeeds when local populations perceive peacekeepers as impartial enforcers of the peace. And the key thing to remember here is that for people that are participating in these disputes, their life or death matters. So in Mali, there are cattle herders who wake up one morning and find that all of their cattle has been slaughtered just because they accidentally trespassed on someone else's property. And so now those cattle herders may worry that if they don't take action, they will be next. And this is a kind of fundamental dilemma where people can be tempted to take action preventatively just to protect themselves, because they worry that if they maintain the status quo and they don't do anything, today it was their cattle, but tomorrow it may be them. This is something that's sometimes known as the security dilemma, where you take actions to protect your own security, and in taking those actions, you may make the other party more insecure. Now, this is where third parties typically come in. Where communal disputes proliferate, a part of the problem is that there is no state, there is no police, there's no law, there is no third party to help reassure both sides that they don't need to actually take actions to secure themselves. This is where international interveners can be very effective. They can come in and reassure both the cattle herder as well as the farmers who may have slaughtered those cattle and be thinking about the next step, that their security is assured. Now, the mistake that many people make, including militaries around the world, is that thinking that the threat of force and punishment is sufficient. But the problem with that line of thinking is that social psychology teaches us that people have prior beliefs about how others will behave or who they like. and that extends to international interveners. So if a farmer threatens to punish a herder in a communal dispute, but the herder worries that peacekeeper is just biased in favor of the farmer, then they may take their chances with preventive violence anyways. So this is why it's so important to have impartial peacekeepers, because they can do a good job convincing, reassuring both sides in a communal dispute that they don't need to take further actions to secure themselves.
Okay, so your core argument is that it's the impartiality of international peacekeepers that really affects their ability to keep a lid on communal violence. Now, what it means for international peacekeepers to be impartial or to be perceived as impartial might vary from context to context. The setting that you're studying is post-colonial sub-Saharan Africa. Could you talk a bit about how the legacy of colonialism has specific implications for who is and who isn't perceived as being impartial?
Yeah, absolutely. The legacy of colonialism is critical for understanding my argument, and I think sort of critical for understanding politics in sub-Saharan Africa. So the way that it factors in specifically to my argument is that colonialism is one of those things that shapes prior beliefs. It's one of those things that shapes how people think about the present. So the legacy of colonialism has this very extended shadow, especially when it comes to thinking about modern day international interveners. Because above all else, colonial occupiers were foreign interveners. And so given the long shadow of colonialism, this is something that is going to continue to shape who someone thinks of as impartial or biased. And there's something specific about colonialism and the nature of colonialism, because occupiers favored some groups typically over others. So it's not just that domestic populations living across the African continent will be thinking about colonial occupiers and international interveners in the same way. There's a lot of heterogeneity because some ethnic groups are treated much better, or at least perceived to be treated much better, by local groups. And given the centrality of perceptions of bias and favoritism to my argument, I just found it critical to really incorporate and think through the legacies of colonialism. And so as part of my research process, I actually spent quite a bit of time immersing myself in the broader comparative politics literature on colonialism and the legacies of colonialism. And I even had this period where I engaged with the art and the music from the African continent during the 60s and 70s, just to kind of understand really how people were thinking about these very formative decades for sub-Saharan African politics. And obviously a lot of that doesn't necessarily make it into the words of the book, but it's definitely made it into my thinking, which then makes it into the words of the book. The legacies of colonialism matter specifically for my argument because colonial occupiers had a tendency to favor some groups over others. And this is absolutely the case in Mali, where the French tended to favor northern groups like the Tuareg over southern groups like the Mandé. And this is a shared and widely held belief among local groups living there. So any Mandé Malian will not be perceiving a French peacekeeper as impartial in a dispute with the Tuareg Malian, because there is exactly this history of the French favoring Tuareg over Mandé Malian.
So your argument also has some specific implications for thinking about the UN. You argue that the UN is especially well-suited to meeting your theory's demands of impartiality. Why is that?
So I think UN has several distinct advantages. The first is that it's this multilateral international organization. There's lots of cooperative councils and bodies where different countries from around the world get a lot of input. And as part of that, it's very diverse. So there's 193 sovereign bodies, including members from every African country. This is a lot of people getting input into this international international organization. And it's also very important to just realize that the UN's rules of engagement on the ground for peacekeeping forces are fundamentally different from those of any military. So they prescribe violence against civilians. The UN peacekeepers will never be attacking civilians. They're also only going to initiate violence against any other armed parties when they feel civilians are being threatened. And so this is fundamentally different than any other military or military actor around the world. The multilateral nature of the UN, the diversity of its membership body, and these kinds of rules of engagement altogether really make it much more well-suited to be an impartial peacekeeping intervener in communal disputes.
That all makes a lot of sense, but I guess I'm still sort of wondering about the ways in which the UN is ultimately a political body. It has this governing council, security council with 5 permanent members with vetoes, each having strong geostrategic agendas around the world. Why is it that that doesn't ultimately serve to undermine perceptions of UN impartiality?
I would note, first of all, that this diverse sovereign body has moved to make the veto less important historically, especially in light of Russian atrocities in Ukraine. And so there is this sense, at least, that you get a say, even if it's not with everything, and that the UN Security Council can veto some of these things. But of course, the veto does undermine some perceptions of impartiality. I think one key point here is that my claim is definitely a relative one. It's not that the UN will be absolutely perceived as impartial by every single person, but that sometimes when the alternative is France, and France has a very powerful colonial legacy, the UN seems quite impartial. And this is even more true when it comes to local level communal disputes rather than country level disputes. A lot of times in civil wars, the UN is only there to literally take the side of the government and help the government rebuild and protect the government from rebel organizations. And in those cases, the bias of the UN peacekeeping operations is very clear. But in a communal dispute between cattle herders and farmers, these kinds of potential biases just don't play out in the same way.
Let's start with the understanding of peacekeepers as top-down enforcers. What's the basic claim there, and why is it that this view can't explain UN peacekeepers' success in mitigating communal violence?
By top-down enforcers, what we really mean is just military deployment of boots on the ground. The main idea of these types of explanation is that more boots on the ground can mitigate communal violence by creating buffer zones that separate warring parties. But the problem here is that this is actually the opposite of what we want peacekeeping at the local level to do. These are people engaged in disagreements and disputes with other groups or individuals that they want to live with, or that they should live with potentially for an indefinite amount of time. So we don't want to separate people. We want to keep them together, and we want to try to figure out what peacekeeping can do to keep those people together. And that's really the exact opposite of how this top-down enforcement mechanism works.
Then there's a view that's about the primacy of institutions, that keeping the peace is about building robust post-conflict institutions. Why don't you think this argument gives us much leverage on the problem of communal violence?
I think it gets us a long way there as a best case solution in the long run. And there's great work that UN-led institution building has succeeded in mitigating communal violence in places like Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia by Hannah Schmidt, Rob Blair, Sabrina Karim, Ben Morse, and many others. But the issue fundamentally is that places like Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia were at peace when the institution building started. And the problem is that in many of these countries where the UN is deployed, in Mali, in South Sudan, Central African Republic, in the Congo, there's an active conflict, or there's belligerents such as violent extremists that are just not going to adhere to a peace agreement. So there's very little rule of law. There's no institutions that actually have a chance to flourish and grow. We don't have the time or the peace to allow institutions to mitigate communal violence, because communal violence is happening as those institutions are growing.
And then finally, there's an argument out there that runs in the exact opposite direction to yours, one that says that what you actually want are biased peacekeepers, peacekeepers who clearly favor one side. It's not obvious how bias might be helpful for resolving conflict. So take us through that logic and where you think it goes wrong.
To get at the logic of this argument, it's useful, I think, to separate out the effect of bias itself and what it implies. What it implies is that if you have a biased peacekeeper, this is a peacekeeper that is really invested in some element of the conflict. Many people who believe in biased peacekeeping believe that you need a third party that is really invested in the conflict succeeding. And the most invested peacekeepers are those that have some sort of bias. But the issue for me with this type of explanation is that it implies something really problematic about the peacekeeper, and that's that they have this bias that comes along with their investment. So it's a case like the French in Mali, where they may be very well invested in the actual outcome of a conflict or any given conflict, but they carry with them as part of that investment this bias, or at least this perceived bias in favor of some groups rather than others. So taking a step back from these three particular explanations, it's not the case that communal violence can be solved by separating people. And in many cases, you just don't have the time to create the institutions that can mitigate communal violence from the top down. It's not going to be the case that biased peacekeepers are going to help resolve these disputes. Instead, what I argue is the exact opposite. It's that it's impartial peacekeepers that can usefully not take the side of either party in the conflict. I can come in and help mitigate this communal violence.
Let's now turn to the book's empirical analyses. You take various steps to test implications of your theory, and the first thing you do is to examine the relationship between peacekeeping operations and communal violence across sub-Saharan Africa over roughly the last two decades. To do this analysis, you had to create your own data set because there was no comprehensive data set on where peacekeeping operations are. Could you tell us about the data set you and Patrick Honeycutt generated and how you put it together?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the time when I started this research, there was a lot of cross-national data at country level. So we knew, for example, how many peacekeepers there were in Mali, and we knew how many peacekeepers there were in Liberia. What we didn't know was how many peacekeepers were there every month to different localities in Mali, to different neighborhoods, to different areas. And given the very localized nature of what I'm interested in, I really had to know more. And at first, I didn't really know if this was possible using cross-national data. I didn't know if this was possible using any sort of quantitative data. And then I had this great interview with the UN police commissioner in Bamako, capital of Mali. And during the meeting, I noticed that he had all of these maps with all around his office, and they had all kinds of details about UN police officers and their gender, their nationality, really everything all around Mali. After some unsuccessful attempts at getting that data from him and other UN police commissioners and UN officials, I decided to go and collect it on my own. I knew from seeing that data that the UN definitely had this data internally, but I just needed to do my best to collect it. And so what my colleague Patrick Honeycutt and I did was we put together this data set, which we call the RAD-PKO data set, which anybody can go and download. We update it every year or so. And we got access to monthly deployment numbers of every UN peacekeeping operation around the world. We were able to get from the UN monthly reports for the self-reported gender, nationality, and troop type of every UN peacekeeping personnel. And so we had that data. What the UN didn't tell us is where they were deployed, but we were able to use their nationality and peacekeeping type to cross-reference with these deployment maps that we were also able to collect. So by using those maps and the data that we had collected by asking the UN very nicely repeatedly, we were able to triangulate the exact location of UN peacekeepers, which was this data then that we didn't have before. And the data that I really needed, I felt, to really be able to analyze the effectiveness of UN peacekeeping operations at the local level. This data set is something that I'm incredibly proud of, but it just would not be possible without the work of dozens of undergraduate and graduate students that have helped me put this together. I really owe them a huge debt of gratitude.
You then want to use this really geographically granular data set to see if peacekeeping deployments that are perceived by local populations as unbiased reduce communal violence in the places they're deployed. And even once you have the data that you need, there are still a couple of additional challenges here. One is that it's not possible for you to measure perceptions of unbiasedness directly across such a vast sweep of space and time. How do you deal with this?
Yeah, this is a very, very tough problem, especially because we're looking at different countries and across different years. And it's especially really challenging because the data is so localized. So there was just no way that I was going to be able to collect comprehensive survey level data, for example. Even databases that I find really useful, like the Afrobarometer, just don't have enough data at such a fine-grained local level. So I tried to use the next best thing. And that was the nationality of peacekeepers as a heuristic, as a way of understanding the perception of peacekeepers. Using nationality as a heuristic allows me to group together different types of peacekeeping contributors as biased or not biased. And in particular, there's two categories of troop contributing countries that I categorize as being perceived as biased. The first group are from countries like in Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, that could largely be implicated in colonialism or are perceived as implicated in colonialism. And the second category are countries from the neighboring region that share similar ethnic cleavages where the peacekeepers could have a stake in a communal dispute themselves, or at least be perceived to have a stake because they come from a country that has similar ethnic groups.
And then a second challenge is establishing that any association you observe reflects a causal effect of peacekeeping on communal violence and not some other selection effect, that it's levels of local violence that are actually driving where the peacekeepers get sent in the first place. And we can imagine this working in different ways. First, maybe the peacekeepers get sent to the quieter places so that they themselves are at lower risk or that they're dealing with more tractable conflicts, in which case looking at a naive correlation of peacekeepers and violence levels would give you an upwardly biased estimate of the effect of peacekeeping. Second, maybe peacekeepers are actually sent to the most conflict-ridden places, in which case you'd likely be underestimating the effect. And third, there could even be selection effects in terms of which countries peacekeepers get sent where. Maybe the former colonial powers or neighboring countries send their troops to more violent places than the UN does. How are you thinking about the various forms of potential confounding here? Which way do you think selection effects are likely to be biasing your estimates? And how do you address the problem?
Yeah, so the key for me here was really getting to know how peacekeeping works and really understanding the selection effects that are inherent in the assignment of peacekeepers, both from the UN Security Council to the country, but also within the country where peacekeepers go. So as part of the research process, really getting into the nuts and bolts of peacekeeping operations was critical. I wasn't very concerned about getting an upwardly biased estimate of the effect of UN peacekeeping because just by the nature of UN peacekeeping operations, I found out that they tend to go to the most violent countries, and within those violent countries, they tend to seek out places that are the most unstable. So just as a result of that selection process, I knew that they would be going into these places that would be the most likely then to escalate and become violent. So I was actually worried that I would be underestimating the effectiveness of UN peacekeeping operations. And the basic concern of confounding is essentially that I'm comparing places that have peacekeepers with those that don't, and that they differ in many other ways. So that there's these areas, these localities where peacekeepers don't go that are just different from those where peacekeepers do go that I don't really know. So this is called, you know, omitted variable bias, confounding, selection, however we want to the term. And the general solution that I used to address this was a matching procedure that basically allowed me to create a data set where I took away as many of these localities from the analysis as possible, leaving only those that were close matches. The way that the matching procedure worked is that it allowed me to take these areas where the peacekeepers go and match them up directly to areas where peacekeepers don't go that were as similar as possible to the ones where they do go. And I measured specifically all of these things that I knew from my qualitative reading of peacekeeping operations peacekeepers really cared about in terms of selecting conflicts. So things like what were the past levels of violence, how far was each locality from the capital city. So what the matching procedure allows me to do is ensure that the areas that I'm comparing are as similar as possible on the confounding variables. And I know exactly which those confounding variables are, or at least the ones that we are most concerned with, because I had gotten to know these nuts and bolts of the internal UN peacekeeping selection procedure.
So you use this matched sample to examine the relationship between the numbers of peacekeeping troops from different kinds of countries and levels of communal violence. What do you find?
So there's two main findings. The first finding is that biased peacekeepers, those either from neighboring countries or from former colonizing powers, are not associated with any change in communal violence. But I do find that peacekeepers from African countries that don't share ethnic cleavages and from non-Western countries outside of the African continent, so these are the ones that are most likely to be perceived as impartial, are negatively associated with communal violence. This means that the more peacekeepers the UN sends from these impartially perceived countries, the less communal violence we should observe in those places where the peacekeepers went. And this is not true for peacekeepers from neighboring countries or from Western countries that can be implicated in colonialism. And in the analysis, I zero in on the case of Darfur, and I create two fictional universes. One where the UN sent 5,000 peacekeepers to Darfur from East Africa, the same region as Darfur, and another fictional universe where the UN sent 5,000 African peacekeepers, but from West, Central, and Southern Africa. So these are peacekeepers that will be perceived as impartial. And what I find is that in the fictional universe where peacekeepers came from the same region as Darfur, communal violence increased by 50%, while in the other universe, communal violence was nearly eliminated. And what I really like about this specific example is that Darfur is this case that the UN has really cared about, but struggled to reduce communal violence. So peacekeeping can succeed even when it comes from countries that have traditionally been maligned as peacekeepers. These are countries from West, Central, and Southern Africa that I think can be quite effective in the peacekeeping endeavor, especially when it focuses on communal violence.
For the rest of your analysis, you then focus on the country of Mali. Can you set the stage for us there and tell us what brought UN peacekeepers to the country, what the lines of communal conflict look like there, and how colonialism has left its mark on these dynamics?
So the UN peacekeeping first came to Mali in 2013, and it was in response to a separatist ethnic conflict that began in Mali in 2012. And this was an ethnic conflict between separatists from the Tuareg ethnic group living largely in the northern part of the country and the government and its affiliated ethnic groups, mostly the Mande ethnic group, living mostly in the southern part of the country. And this division between North and South is something that had carried over from colonial times when France had largely divided the country up into North and South. And in the South, France ruled with a much heavier hand, typically sending its own local governors to administer laws and the country in a more direct way. And in the North, taking a much more loose approach, delegating a lot of authority to Tuareg clan and tribal leaders. These these divisions carried through to the 1960s, where upon gaining their independence, a lot of the southern groups in Mali were resentful of the favoritism that the northern groups, including the Tuareg, had received during colonialism. One of the first things that the Mandé government did upon gaining independence from France in the 60s was establish a national form of rule grounded in a Mandé nationalism. And this has, from the 1960s all the way through 2012, when the most recent ethnic conflict began, really created a lot of resentment among the Tuareg population, which again, during colonialism, was used to a very favorable treatment from the colonial occupying force. So many Tuareg Malians actually view Mandé governance as more negative than French colonial governance. And French colonial governance is actually viewed quite positively in comparison to what they view as the internal colonialism of the southern Mandé government. So a lot of the current tensions in Mali stem from a desire of Tuareg ethnic groups really wanting to seek their own autonomy in response to what they perceive as the cruel treatment and discrimination of the southern government. This is what initially created the civil war and the conflict in Mali. The latest conflict in Mali that began in 2012 and then precipitated French intervention in January 2013 and the UN peacekeeping operation in June 2013 was just the latest iteration of this conflict between Tuareg and Mandé that has been raging in Mali for decades. And at first, it started off as a very elite level conflict between these separatist groups and their political leaders and the government and the Malian military. But eventually, this boiled over to a lot of communal violence. And this occurred for several reasons. One of the reasons is that large-scale ethnic conflict creates a lot of instability. It creates a lot of opportunities for violent groups and violent organizations to take advantage of communal disputes that were already there and escalate them by providing the kind of violent assistance that just wasn't there before. Another way that the ethnic conflict that began at the country level has boiled over into the communities is that it's created a lot of refugees, people from the north that have been forced south into central and southern Mali, who are forced onto the territory of people who have lived there for decades prior. And now they're existing in this place where there's very little government control because the government has been incredibly diminished by the civil war and has very little authority over these territories. But all of a sudden, there are now groups competing over the same land. All of these things have kind of come together. So you have this conflict that began as a very elite level conflict about these big ideologies and separatism and autonomy and ethnic resentments, and now is a much more local level phenomenon. And in fact, many more Malians die every year from communal violence than on the battlefield between rebel groups and the military.
As part of your research in Mali, you did about 50 interviews with local leaders. What did you learn from those conversations?
There's two big themes that emerge from my conversations with local leaders in Mali. The first is just an extreme frustration and disappointment with government and their inability to deal with violence at all levels. That includes communal violence as well as the more country-level violence. And they see communal violence as the big threat to their country, but they also see the government not doing much. And they blame the government's inaction and inability to help address disputes for the proliferation of communal violence. Several people fear these self-defense groups, these militias that have come about that help people escalate communal disputes into violence. What came across in these conversations was just that people really see this as a big problem and they're frustrated with the lack of government intervention. And then the other thing that came across is that people are really asking for the international community to do more. So this isn't just the UN, which is the the major focus of my study, but they're asking for the international community to help in many different avenues and to do many different things. One of the things that's clear here is that just people really think that it's the absence of a kind of third-party authority, whether it be the state or the international community or just the rule of law, anything, that is fundamentally responsible for creating these higher levels of communal violence.
Most of the rest of the empirical sections of the book consist of a set of experiments that you ran in Mali. For some of these experiments, you were essentially running lab-style studies in the field. Usually, we think of a lab experiment as being carried out under a set of highly controlled conditions, often, for instance, in a pretty teched-up room on a university campus. I'm guessing this was not the situation you were in carrying out these experiments. What was it like conducting lab-style experiments in the field, and what were some of the challenges you confronted?
Yeah, so I knew early on in my research process that I wanted to do a lab experiment because I was fundamentally interested in the microdynamics of when people from different groups cooperate and when they work together and when they don't. But when I got to the field, I realized that this was going to be much easier said than done. As you mentioned, traditionally, we think of lab experiments as being in a very controlled setting, and I arrived with a preconceived notion of what that would look like, and with even software that was pre-programmed for running a lab experiment. And I very quickly had to throw all of that out the window. So one of the challenges was that I didn't really even know where I was going to hold the lab experiment. It was difficult to figure out the exact locale because you need to ensure, for example, that you have this randomized treatment and people are going to be interacting and that they're separated from each other. They don't find out about what's happening with the other person's treatment or that they're not influenced by the treatment is occurring. I was able to find this abandoned government building that I brought people to, and I rented out different floors. And one of the floors had like this very big room that I thought was going to be ideal. But problem was, again, that I couldn't just bring in everybody there because they might overhear different conversations or see what different people were doing. So I had to create separation. How do you create a separation? Well, I had many, many conversations with my friends and colleagues in Mali about this. And one of the ideas was you get curtains. So one of my friends, his mom got us some textiles, which we were able to take and use as curtain separators to make sure that each so-called lab was different for all of the individuals that we brought into the room to do the lab experiment. So even though it's still called the lab in the field experiment, the nature of the lab is just fundamentally different than we might think of when we hear the word lab. Another manifestation of these kinds of unforeseen challenges of doing a lab in the field experiment is that I came in with this idea that I was going to be able to randomize the treatment at the individual level. Basically, each person was going to be able to randomly get a different form of treatment. But that is much harder to do if you don't have a computer randomly assigning people to treatments. And I didn't have a computer. So without the benefit of having a computer deliver the randomized treatment, I couldn't have individual level randomization. Instead, I had to group the randomization of the treatment in the lab experiment at a higher level where I could actually manipulate it.
Tell us about how this lab in the field experiment was set up. What was the basic experimental design?
Yeah, so I wanted to measure the willingness of individuals to cooperate. So what I did is I played a version of what behavioral economists call a trust game. Each participant in the trust game was instructed to send money to an anonymous partner from a different ethnic group. And so specifically, I recruited from the Mande ethnic group, and I tasked them with sending some of an initial salary endowment that I gave them to members from the Tuareg group. So this was the cleavage that I'm really interested in studying. And I randomly assigned participants to either a control group or one of two treatment groups. If they were in a treatment group, they were told that two patrolling officers from either the UN or France would punish any low contributions to the Tuareg partner with the fine. and then to identify specifically the effect of peacekeeping on their willingness to contribute to their Tuareg partner, I compare the amount that each participant sent in the control group when they didn't have any peacekeeping to the treatment groups where they had either UN peacekeeping or French peacekeeping.
And what did you find? What difference did the stated presence and identity of the third-party peacekeepers make to the levels of contributions that Mandé participants made towards Tuaregs?
So what I find is quite striking. Those in the group that were assigned a UN peacekeeping treatment sent on average about 33% more than those either in the control group or to those assigned to French peacekeeping. So this is direct evidence that the identity of a peacekeeper increases the willingness of individuals to cooperate with members of another ethnic group. That is what this increase in contributions in the UN peacekeeping treatment group versus the control and versus the French peacekeeping treatment group really shows us. So the part of the theory that I really want to test with this lab in the field experiment is the link between perceptions of an impartial peacekeeper and the willingness to cooperate with members of another ethnic group in a communal dispute.
How confident can we be that the effect that you find arises specifically from perceived differences in the biasness of the peacekeepers, or that it derives from the legacy of French colonialism versus the multilateralism of UN intervention? You haven't actually directly manipulated these actors' biasness or anything to do with colonialism. You've manipulated the identities of these notional peacekeepers, whether they're from the UN or French. And these are, of course, real-world actors who differ from each other in lots of possible ways. So how do we know that participants aren't reacting to some other feature of these actors rather than their perceived unbiasedness?
Yeah, that's a great question because you're exactly right. One of the trade-offs of doing a lab experiment in the field is that sometimes you have to manipulate things in an experimental setting in ways that are true to the field, but don't necessarily get to the exact mechanism you're trying to test. So that's the sacrifice that I made by using an actual actor here, such as France or UN, where I knew that they were associated with impartiality and bias, but those aren't exactly the quantities that I am changing and testing. And so to address that concern, I did a few things. In the actual reading of the treatment in the lab experiment, I held constant the nature of the peacekeeping. So the only thing that varied was the identity itself. So perhaps people may have thought that French peacekeepers have more localized capacity than UN peacekeepers. Well, in this case, I was able to control for that by making sure that people understood that there were two peacekeeping officers stationed in the building, so they had an identical capacity. The other thing I did is I asked every single one of the participants how much they thought that the Tuareg partner that they were playing the game with had returned to them. So this tests whether they think that the peacekeeper that was there monitoring the interaction was biased or not. And what I find is that those assigned to the French peacekeeping group believed that the Tuareg had sent back less to them than those assigned to the UN peacekeeping group. So there was something about the French peacekeepers that made people believe that the Tuareg wouldn't be sending back as much. But that didn't occur in the UN peacekeeping group. And I think the most important way is that I just talked to the participants themselves. And it became very obvious that people had very, very clear ideas and notions tied to France that they didn't have to the UN. And a lot of those ideas about France were explicitly by the participants tied back to colonialism. I heard a lot of France favors the Tuareg. I'm not going to send this because I just know that France is out there looking out for my partner, but not for me. Or I know that France is taking the side of the rebels in this conflict. So a lot of that came out in the interviews. In the UN, it's an entirely different story. A lot of the participants in the interviews would say things like, well, I trust the UN more because it didn't colonize Mali. I trust the UN more because it is an international institution. So these are the very things that I had theorized would matter and create perceptions of the UN's impartiality. And this absolutely came out in the interviews when I spoke to each participant about why they sent the amount that they did.
Now I'd like to ask a little bit about the ethics behind conducting this kind of lab experiment. Notably, your experiment involves deception on two levels. First, your Monde participants were not actually playing against a Tuareg recipient. And second, there were no peacekeepers enforcing the agreement. And of course, you're working with participants in a context in which, according to your own analysis, low social trust is a major source of instability. So how should we be thinking about the ethics of this kind of a design?
It was something that I've wrestled with a lot. And even the design of the experiment itself came about from months of having conversations with Molly and colleagues about how best to implement it. And for me, the most important thing was to ensure the safety of not just the participants, but also my research team. I worked with 17 people when I was implementing this on the ground, and these are 17 people that are going to go back and live within their communities, and it was extremely important for me to safeguard those 17 people and the 500 people that were participating in the study. At the same time, I wanted to do research about how best to keep the peace in an unstable setting. So how do you do both of those things? There were two things that I settled on. The first was to not invite the UN or France to be involved in this in any way. And in fact, I was uneasy with my own presence in a lot of the experiment itself. I didn't want to have any sort of international heavy hand here. And then the second thing is not involving any Tuareg participants, not having anyone there that could potentially invite some sort of instability or provoke any conflict or violence in the actual research setting, because then I couldn't actually guarantee the safety of the other participants or my team. So given that I wanted to do these two things to ensure the safety of my research team and the participants, I then made sure these lengthy interviews that I held with each of the participants after the experiment was done, that I debriefed them, I explained the protocol, I explained the purpose of the study, and no participant in the interview expressed any serious concerns with either type of deception, and was the most important thing to us. And ultimately, what made me comfortable with the uses of deception here is that all of my research participants were safe, and a lot of the participants expressed gratitude and happiness that we were doing research on national reconciliation, and we were doing research on bringing people together in communities and figuring out what works and what doesn't. Because ultimately, this is a project that was conducted very much in collaboration with Malians, and the purpose of benefiting Malian society moving forward.
In addition to this lab experiment, you also conduct a survey experiment that you use specifically to help get at how peacekeepers' identities affect expectations about the escalation of violence, which is another key moving part of your theory. How is that survey experiment set up, and what do you find?
In the survey experiment, I moved to a different level of analysis. So the lab experiment was very much concerned with the inter-individual interaction at the micro level, and testing how perceptions of impartiality of a peacekeeper can help manage cooperation between individuals. I administered a survey to 20 rural and peri-urban communities across Mali, where I present respondents with a vignette describing a very typical land dispute between cattle herders and farmers in a very hypothetical manner. And it's between members from two different ethnic groups, one a traditionally cattle herding ethnic group and the other one a traditionally farming ethnic group. And then I randomly assign whether some respondents were told that a peacekeeping patrol, either from the UN or France, discovers that dispute, or whether there's no peacekeeper that discovers that dispute. And then I ask them whether they think that dispute will become violent or not. Again, the findings here are quite clear. 19% of my respondents believe that the dispute would escalate if the UN discovered it, in comparison to 39% for those that said the dispute would escalate if French peacekeepers discovered it, and 42% who said that they believed that it would escalate if no peacekeepers found out about it. So what you're seeing here is that there's a difference between UN peacekeeping's effectiveness on communal violence and that of French peacekeepers, and that of no peacekeeping whatsoever. So this is, again, evidence that there's something about the UN that's able to decrease communal violence. This finding ties back directly to the security dilemma logic that's at the core of my theoretical argument. And so what the UN is doing is reducing people's beliefs that communal violence will break out and that their surroundings will become insecure. And again, the nature of the security dilemma is that if you're able to change people's beliefs about how secure or insecure they are, you make them less likely to pursue the types of actions that will make others feel insecure at the same time.
And finally, you leverage variation in peacekeeping deployments within Mali to examine their relationship to the outbreak of violence, partly by exploiting a natural experiment on the Mali-Burkina Faso border. Can you tell us about that natural experiment?
So this is, again, one of those things where it's a quantitative analysis, but it's really the product of happy accident of a lot of qualitative research and just reading and finding out more and more about the nuts of the way that UN peacekeepers operate. So in this part of the study, what I do is I compare communal violence in Mali to that in Burkina Faso, which is right across this border. And this is the border between Mali and Burkina Faso is incredibly porous, and it's basically non-existent for Malians and Burkinabe that just go between the two countries all the time. And in fact, the ethnic divisions are present on both sides. And this is not a very strict border, especially in the parts of the two countries that are just to the south of the Saharan Desert. So for most purposes, these are fundamentally identical parts of the country close to the border. The main difference between the two countries is that Mali has UN peacekeeping operations and that Burkina Faso doesn't. And it turns out that because of how the UN operates, peacekeepers really care about international law and keeping to international borders. State sovereignty really matters for the UN to the point that patrols that are near the border with Burkina Faso will go out with GPS units and make sure that they don't cross over into Burkina Faso. And then they will learn the physical landmarks around those borders and around the GPS coordinates that are on the Mali side of the border. So knowing this about the selection process of UN peacekeeping, I can then compare those areas on the Mali side of the border to those areas on the Burkina side of the border and really get a nice comparison, because the only difference is that on the Mali side, you have UN peacekeepers and on the Burkina side, you don't. And what I find is that comparing similar looking localities on different sides of the border, there's much less violence in Mali than there is in Burkina Faso. And again, if we accept that these are similar places in every single way, except that Mali has peacekeepers, then that again is very compelling evidence for the effectiveness of the UN.
You also find a difference between levels of communal violence in areas patrolled by peacekeepers from Senegal versus areas patrolled by peacekeepers from Togo. Why is that important for your theory?
Well, this matters because Malians perceive peacekeepers from Senegal as biased in favor of Fulani cattle herders that live in central Mali, but they don't have those perceptions about peacekeepers from Togo. And the reason for that is that Fulani cattle herders are a big, powerful ethnic constituency in Senegal, but not in Togo. This is an example of what I was talking about earlier with a neighboring country that has similar ethnic cleavages. What my theory would expect is that peacekeepers from Togo would be perceived as more impartial than peacekeepers from Senegal. And what I find is exactly that peacekeepers from Senegal are actually less able to mitigate communal violence than peacekeepers from Togo. And what I suggest is that this is because peacekeepers from Togo are perceived by Malians to be much more impartial than peacekeepers from Senegal, exactly because they don't share those ethnic cleavages.
You argue that the factors that determine UN peacekeeping success at the local communal level are different than those that determine success at the country level. Why is that? Why isn't perception of impartiality just as important for keeping armed groups and militias from attacking one another.
I think the key thing to remember here is that there's fundamentally different mechanisms that allow for the construction of national level peace versus community level peace. And I think it's very, very plausible, for example, that the creation of buffer zones could maintain peace by keeping warring parties apart. So the creation of a buffer zone through the deployment of a biased military could be very effective as long as it manages to keep one side from attacking the other. But as I've discussed, the communal violence requires a much softer touch. It requires really getting to know populations, really making sure that you can reassure people to the individual level that you can protect them from violence from different ethnic groups. And that's going to require also reassuring them in a way that allows them to live together in that same community for a long time. So I think that it is not something where you just can apply force or you can apply the type of top-down enforcement that I think might be effective if your only goal is to prevent armed groups from attacking one another.
We've been talking a lot about the UN as a potentially impartial peacekeeping body, but is there something specific about the UN that makes it uniquely capable of serving this role? Or are there other third parties that could also potentially play the role of impartial monitors or enforcers? For instance, NGOs or regional bodies. What other international actors could you see successfully keeping the peace at the communal level?
I think that the UN has a lot of natural advantages. For example, over NGOs, the UN is able to actually deploy military forces that can manage and enforce communal peace at the local level. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the UN. And there's nothing about my theory that specifically requires the UN for the theory to work. We could imagine other international organizations having that multilateral advantage that the UN also has. For example, NATO or the European Union have carried out at least partial peacekeeping operations in some countries. Now, I would wonder the extent to which those organizations would still be perceived as impartial given their association with Western European countries, but it's certainly a possibility. There's also the potential for regional actors, ECOWAS, the African Union, and again, the concern here would be that does the bias that I'm talking about, not from former colonizers, but from neighboring countries that share ethnic cleavages, could that come about? I think that's possible, but perhaps some of these peacekeeping operations could be constructed in a way that is maybe a little bit more creative. So you have an African Union operation in West Africa that doesn't rely on West African troops. That's certainly possible and would absolutely be in line with some of the findings that I have about the effectiveness of African peacekeepers that are not from neighboring countries sharing the same ethnic cleavage.
As a matter of policy implications, your findings imply that the UN or any other peacekeeping entity should maximize impartiality in choosing or allocating peacekeepers. But are there trade-offs here? In some sense, impartiality, or being from a country that is nowhere near or has no historical relationship with the receiving country, can also equate to being ignorant about the local context, which might be a real disadvantage in being able to navigate the complexities of a conflict. So are there things that impartial peacekeepers can't do as well as peacekeepers with more historical connection and local knowledge of place?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're hitting on the main trade-off. If you're sending peacekeepers from a place that they know, then you are getting a benefit, even in the actual gathering and collecting of information about communal disputes. But there's one important difference here that I want to highlight is that the way that many policymakers have traditionally conceived of having local level knowledge is something like speaking the lingua franca. And in many cases, that doesn't actually get you very far, or it may introduce bias. In that case, you're kind of getting the worst of both worlds. For example, French peacekeepers in West Africa are absolutely going to speak the lingua franca, but they're not necessarily going to be perceived as impartial, as I've discussed. And by contrast, you could have peacekeepers, like I was discussing in the Togo example, that both speak the lingua franca, so they speak French, but they aren't perceived as biased because they don't share the same ethnic cleavage. So that's the kind of nuance that I'm suggesting would be very beneficial, where you can minimize at least some of the trade-offs between giving up the local level knowledge and comes from knowing a place and being affiliated with a place and being perceived as favoring one ethnic group over another because of historical ties to that place.
In this conversation, we've kind of been talking about UN peacekeepers as this benevolent force. But over the last few years, especially, there have been revelations of fairly widespread sexual exploitation and sexual violence perpetrated by UN peacekeepers. What's your sense of how that has affected the UN's ability to play this role of impartial arbiter and enforcer of the peace?
I think that's a really important question to ask, especially because a key part of my theory is that it's the UN's non-use of force and violence against civilians that allows it to be perceived as impartial. And so when peacekeepers commit these heinous acts of sexual exploitation and violence, they're really undermining not only the UN's legitimacy, but the very thing that I highlight as important to the UN's effectiveness. And so I think that the key thing here is to understand that there's a limits on the use of military power, and there's limits to what troops can do. And I think this is especially true in the case of UN peacekeepers that are deployed to these settings where they have a lot of local interactions and there's a lot of opportunities for sexual exploitation and abuse. So I think it's very important for the UN to try as much as possible to keep troops accountable. And there's been a push recently to increase the amount of UN intervention, especially in difficult settings, and allow countries a freer hand in the operation of UN peacekeepers. But what that would do is it would allow troops to operate unfettered and without enough supervision. Instead, what my theory says about the effectiveness of UN peacekeepers is that you actually require a very, very small and light application of military force to be effective. And because my theory doesn't suggest, like country-level theories about civil war, that you need to station military troops to physically separate warring parties, I think that there's things that UN peacekeepers could do with a much softer touch and where the UN is much more able to monitor what each individual peacekeeper is doing without having to delegate a lot of autonomy to what those peacekeepers are able to do on a daily basis. And I think it's very important that when these sexual exploitation and abuse scandals come to light, the UN pursues them at an international level and doesn't just delegate them to the contributing countries themselves, and that the UN continues to hold its member states accountable for what their troops are doing. Because otherwise, it's absolutely right to say that sexual exploitation and abuse is just going to undermine what the UN is doing. And not just in a broad normative sense, but it's really going to undercut the effectiveness of the UN at this local level that I've theorized. One of the interesting things is that researchers have found that the most frequent perpetrators of sexual exploitation and abuse within UN peacekeeping tend to come from some of the same countries that I highlight as being perceived as biased. So these are former colonizing powers or those that might be perceived as being implicated in the colonial endeavor. Others have theorized that this comes from perceived power hierarchies that some peacekeepers from European countries specifically maintain when they get deployed to African countries. It might be the case both for the UN to limit the amount of sexual exploitation and abuse and to mitigate communal violence in the ways that my theory suggests would be the most productive. The UN should stop relying on a lot of these peacekeepers from countries that might be implicated in a colonialism.
Finally, can you tell us what's the exit strategy here? Having these impartial UN peacekeepers in communities to minimize communal violence is super important, but they obviously can't stay there forever. They can't become permanent fixtures in these communities. So how do peacekeepers leave a place without the whole dynamic deteriorating again?
Yeah, I think this is going to be the key question for the UN moving forward, as I think a lot of these local level operations succeed. And it really comes down to the fact that the UN has to couple localized peace enforcement operations with institution building strategies. So security sector reform, as well as the type of top-down institution building that we've talked about before. So as local level operations, keep the peace, and mitigate communal violence, all that does is that it allows the UN, other international actors, and local communities themselves enough time to build institutions. But then those institutions have to be built to successfully keep the peace until long after the UN is gone. And even as I say that, though, I do want to highlight that there is a potential tension between the two things that I'm describing. For example, Kevin Russell and Nicholas Sambanis have, in a recent study, talked about an institutional dilemma that occurs when international interventions deploy to a country, and those interventions themselves crowd out local leaders so that they're not able to craft legitimate local institutions when that intervener leaves. And so it might be the case that what the UN is doing is that it's buying local leaders enough time and peace to create institutions, but when that time comes to build those institutions, they just don't have the reputation for building those institutions in the long run. I think would be a very interesting extension for what I'm doing here, because I think that it remains an open question under what conditions exit strategies can be successful after the UN has crafted local level peace. I'm not convinced that institution building on its own can succeed, but I'm not sure what can. It might be, for example, that traditional leaders might be instrumental partners in this regard. So Kate Baldwin has done some bunch of great work on how traditional leaders can function as brokers for development and really help further along institution building in fragile settings. And so it might be the case that the UN can collaborate with traditional leaders that have already have those established reputations, so they don't need to worry about crowding out local leaders.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's our episode for today. Our content editors are Sampada KC and Unshil Choi, and our sound editor is Scott Duke Giles.
Our theme music is by the Great North Sound Society. Thanks to UBC's Department of Political Science and the American Political Science Association's Centennial Center for supporting this podcast.
We'll talk to you again soon.